I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano says she's clarifying her weekend comment about that attempted Christmas Day bombing, in which she said that the airline security system worked. Here's Napolitano this morning on the Today Show.
Our system did not work in this instance. No one is happy or satisfied with that. An extensive review is underway.
One question sure to be raised, how did a young man who'd been placed on a U.S. watch list after his parents alerted U.S. officials in Nigeria about fears he'd been radicalized, manage to pay cash for a ticket, board a plane with no luggage, with bomb material strapped to his body? Eric Lipton is covering the story for the New York Times. Eric, you report today that Amsterdam Airport, where he took flight, is one of few with the type of machine that could have detected the bomb material. But these are body scan machines, and officials there say they're not allowed to use that technology on U.S.-bound passengers. Why not?
That's what they've told us. They actually suggested that the United States has told them that it does not want them to use these machines, these very modern machines, on passengers headed for the United States. They could not explain that, and we were not able to get an explanation from authorities in the United States.
Well, one answer might be that these are the machines that have near-naked pictures as a result, but we understand they're not stored. Do you know if it was a question of civil liberties? Or?
There's a lot of sensitivity about the use of those machines right now in the United States. They're voluntary. You have the option of saying, I'd rather have essentially a physical pat-down. And there have been advocates for privacy rights. They call them essentially virtual strip searches. Yeah. And so it's a little unclear just how broadly they're going to be used in the United States.
Well, and this Nigerian student, Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, was placed on a U.S. watch list, as we said, but there are at least three. He was placed on the least restrictive, the terrorist identity data mart environment, which means simply that a file was open on him. We understand 500,000 people are on this watch list. So if he has a file on that list, does that mean anyone was actively looking at it?
What it means is that the United States government knew that there were some questions about him and some doubts about the potential threat he might present, but they were not serious enough to lead them to put him on a no-fly list or on what's called a selectee list, which means that if he were to approach an airport checkpoint, that he would be subject to a pat-down and perhaps some questioning.
But he was also, we understand, placed on a watch list in Britain last May after officials there found out that he was trying to re-enter that country to study at a fictitious university program. He'd already studied at a real college there. So the question is, wouldn't that somehow be flagged if he's then put on a list in the U.S.?
I think that that's certainly one of the lessons that's going to come out of this whole experience is that the use of the much broader watch list, it perhaps needs to be expanded when it comes to doing what's called secondary screening at airports. The problem is most of the time what you hear is complaints about people being subject to these pat-downs, and now the pendulum is swinging the other way where people are saying, well, how come essentially more people are not subject to secondary screening? So there's a balance that needs to be figured out, and I think that we're headed in the other direction at this moment.
Well, and as we're reading it, if not for a failed detonator and some alert passengers, this plane might have blown up.
Right. I mean, one point that a few folks made to me over the weekend, including Michael Chertoff, that used to be Homeland Security Secretary, was that to some extent, I mean, one piece of the system that perhaps you could argue did work is that the screening systems are forcing these would-be terrorists to take aboard things that are harder to actually set off. And so, to some extent, the reason he perhaps was not able to detonate this device is because it was complicated. And the reason it was complicated is because he couldn't carry aboard an intact bomb.
Well, other questions being raised, should there be more profiling of people on watch lists? You say that's probably going to be considered. But also, are all these different lists and reports being connected?
I mean, the fact that a report to an embassy in Nigeria ended up into a federal government system, which any person with some classification in the federal government could have access to, that it, to some extent, is progress. But, of course, what's most important is to prevent these people from getting on the planes. So the system is certainly better than it was, but it's not perhaps where it needs to be.
Let me ask you, Eric, about the politics of all of this over the weekend. There was a lot of to and fro as to whether or not the president should be speaking sooner. There was, of course, criticism of Napolitano's comments. She said she only meant that the system worked after the device went off and all the other airlines were alerted. But then people came forward and said, well, wait a second, George Bush didn't respond to the shoe bomber. It's not the role of the president to sort of elevate these terrorism attempts. How do you see this unfolding politically?
It's a very difficult balance because I think it's correct that the that the president does not want to overreact and cause, you know, fear among the American traveling public on what is the, one of the busiest traveling, you know, periods in the year. But at the same time, he doesn't want to appear to be, you know, on vacation, you know, playing basketball, too detached and uncaring. So it's a difficult situation, and but it's one that has, you know, sort of big implications for the administration in terms of how they're seen and how strong they are on national security issues, I think.
Eric Lipton, reporter for The New York Times. Eric, thanks so much.
Thank you.
One of our favorite books this year was written by Jeffrey Fleischman, a veteran war correspondent who's now the Cairo bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. Not surprisingly, the protagonist in his first novel is also a war correspondent.
Write one true sentence. Somebody said that once, but does it exist? Can syllables and sounds make truth? Is language capable of such precision? I think not. I think the best we get is a composite. We don't even know the truth about ourselves. Look at me. Bleeding bank accounts, too much drink, lost computers, missed interviews, bulletproof vest, endless fights with editors. But in the end, all I need is 1,200 to 1,500 words, and I can compress the world for you. I can move characters like God.
Jeffrey Fleischman's book is Promised Virgins, a Novel of Jihad. The story is set in Kosovo in the 1990s. A fictitious reporter, an American named Jay Morgan, travels back and forth between bitter enemies, the Serbs and the Kosovars. Jay is accompanied by his young translator, Alija, who'd been gang-raped and disfigured by Serb troops. They're both searching, Alija for her missing brother. Did he join the Kosovar rebels? And Jay for a mysterious Arab newcomer preaching jihad years before he'd surface again on 9/11. It's familiar territory for Jeffrey Fleischman. He covered the wars in Kosovo and Iraq. When we spoke earlier this year, I asked him to sort fact from fiction, starting with this character who sounds so much like Osama bin Laden. Was bin Laden ever seen in Kosovo?
No, but there were characters who tried to infiltrate into that guerrilla war that was going on between the Kosovo Liberation Army at the time and the Serbs. Characters who would come in from the Gulf bearing money and ideology and strands of jihad that they were hoping to weave into that picture. They weren't successful, but there were attempts. And so the idea of that came from their attempts of trying to embed themselves in the mountains.
Next question. Is Jay Morgan you?
Parts of him are me. Parts of him are other correspondents. He's much more cynical than I am. I have a bit more optimism about the human spirit and about stories.
Well, we want to talk about that cynicism in a moment. But first, let's meet more of the cast of characters. It's out of Casablanca. You've got Vijay, a Kosovar journalist desperate to get to the U.S. where a fellowship at Harvard's Kennedy School awaits him. A fellow war correspondent named Brian, a Serbian sniper who longs to open a jazz club, a man called the Leopard who's a lawyer turned rebel leader, Rolo, a U.S. intelligence officer. Do these characters represent people you've encountered?
Again, they're fictionalized accounts of either one person or a combination of people. That was the thing about covering wars, and especially Kosovo. There was very much a character like Vijay, although not quite as flamboyant.
Vijay's the one who's coming to the Kennedy School.
Right, he's coming, and he's got that, and he's got this great English language working for him. His syntax is polished, and he's just got this confident air about him. He was one of the characters in real life that you would go to and just check the temperature of what's happening out there on the ground, what's going on in the villages, and he was able to sort of weave it all together.
He's also one of the people that we meet who's trying desperately to sort of play every other character against each other, again, in this desperate attempt almost maybe to get out.
Right.
It doesn't work well for him.
No, and with Vijay, his oversized personality and the intoxication of how some characters view war makes him bigger than he should be, and he tries to put his fingers in too many different places and
becomes a bigger target.
Right.
Yeah. Well, and then, of course, there's Alija, the translator, who sleeps with Jay, the correspondent, although they're not lovers because she's not ready after, you know, what she's been through. So there's this tenderness, but it doesn't go all the way into a relationship. Very complicated. You know, there's a dance going on. What's right. that dance?
The dance is that Alija and Jay are both damaged characters, and they find this kind of inner sanctum with one another in sort of the quiet moments when the war is sort of calmed down for the night.
There's another woman in the picture. She's with Doctors Without Borders, a casual relationship with Jay. Mm. What are you saying about all these people who travel from war to war, with the exception, of course, of the translator? Mm. What are you saying about What kind of relationships happen?
As I said in one part of the book, there's sort of a strange dysfunctional family of characters wanting to do good. I believe most people in war zones, whether they're journalists or Doctors Without Borders, want to bring some kind of healing element, some kind of illumination to it. Some characters are just very intoxicated, like Vijay, to be around it.
Given that, what draws Jay, your character, what drew you? Given that cynicism that you expressed through Jay, I mean, boy, he hates his editors back home. He's well aware that he might risk his life. He'll see horrible death. There's a scene of a mother completely disfigured by a bomb crawling towards a carriage that's empty. There's no baby there, baby blown away. And that may make it to page 9.
Right. He started off not that way, and then over the years he got that way. And with Jay, it's strange because his cynicism is almost his energy. It used to be he would drive it from the naivete that his stories would change things. Now it's his cynicism that drives it, and it's become this thing he just carries with him. He is cynical, but he still believes it's important to tell the stories.
What are your editors saying about this? I mean, you're not kind to the people stateside who are maybe talking to a war correspondent while they're on their cell phone, you know, on a freeway,
right,
complaining about traffic. Here you are, you know, risking your life and changing copy or turning down a story because, well, you know, that's a little off, you know, what we're looking for right now. Meanwhile, you've got an incredible story that you'd love to tell, and it's going to just live in your notepad. What's that like, and what are the people that you work with saying reading that?
Yeah, I don't know yet, but that part of the thing, the relationship between editor and reporter, is always interesting because the editor, you're there and you're in the field and you're doing things. And so you see it firsthand. You're doing the writing. You bring it all back. You collect, you write, you create, and it goes to somebody else. And it's very fragile letting that go. And when you're letting that go from a war zone, it becomes more fragile. For me personally, the editors I work with are terrific. They provide that backdrop that you've gone too far or you've done this or something like that. Some reporters in war zones have constant running battles. I've traveled with a few of them, and every night was just a bloody battle with the editor over a word or an image. And when you're 6,000 or 7,000 miles away, it becomes that much more exacerbated.
But it's not just anger at the editors. It's anger at, the other journalists who sit on the Sunday morning talk shows, as your character Jay calls it, the revenge of the journalists on Sunday morning, doing everything but journalism, speculating, pondering, prattling in polemics. A monkey with a thesaurus can do it. I've never seen these hacks and pundits in the places I am.
I'm drawn toward the tiny story, the story, like T.S. Eliot said, that exists between two waves in the sea. That, to me, is what's really happening. And to hear somebody just prattle on like big empty barrels seems to me a waste of the power of the medium.
That's L.A. Times Cairo Bureau Chief Jeffrey Fleischman. His first novel, Promised Virgins, a novel of jihad. We'll have more with Jeffrey after a break. And later, it sounds like fiction, but this past weekend, among the Iranians killed protesting what they say was a stolen election was the nephew of the candidate who lost. Today, there are reports that his body has disappeared. We'll have much more later on Iran. Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to Here and Now. We're revisiting a conversation with one of our favorite authors from the past year. Jeffrey Fleischman is now Cairo Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times, but his first novel is called Promised Virgins, a novel of jihad. It's set during the war in Kosovo in the 1990s, a war Jeffrey covered. In the book, the main characters are fictional war correspondent Jay Morgan and his translator Alija, a young Kosovar who was brutally assaulted by Serb soldiers. It's hard to know where the real reporter ends and the fictional character Jay begins. In the book, when the fictional Jay was a young cub reporter, he and the woman who became his wife went to Lebanon to work together, and she was killed. So I asked real reporter Jeffrey Fleischman whether he ever experienced that kind of loss covering war.
No. I've had friends who have died during wars, but not like this, no.
And how does that register? Because for Jay, it seems as if you can't really think about it too much.
that part of the book, he's talking about his wife, but it's very compressed. I think it's a page or two, and you would think, how can a man contemplate something so big in his life at the time and reduce it to two pages? But that's how Jay is. The journalist in the war zone is like the shark. It's sort of moving in the water all the time because you can't stop.
There's also a certain kind of sense of the war itself is going to go along no matter what you do. You describe through Jay, he's very aware that there's a certain symmetry, a certain blueprint. You know, how much do you do if you're a Serb before NATO will come in?
Right.
You know, if you're a rebel, a Muslim guerrilla fighter, a Kosovar, how much will you also allow to happen, you know, to provoke NATO to come in? And there's a certain war weariness.
Everyone is pressing up against the edge of their limits for their success. And that's a really interesting thing of human dynamics writ large, because those edges in war obviously collide.
I want to ask you another question. Your character, Jay, is traveling with another journalist correspondent. They trust each other. They've known each other. So he and Brian are traveling together. And we'll break out in a conversation about how they're going to write their stories. You know, even as they're in the midst of, you know, discovering something, they discover the mysterious Arab, Osama bin Laden type enclave. He's left it, and they discover it, and they see, oh, he was an architect. He's drawing pictures. And they were hoping to do suicide bombing, and these bearded men here. So they're bantering, bearded men, architecture, and bombs. I banter, says Jay. Or, says Brian, architecture, bombs, and bearded men. You should end with the strongest word, Jay says. There's a lot of talking about how things are going to be written.
Yeah.
Does that really happen?
Yeah. One, you're sort of probing. You're a guy like, I don't want my lead to read exactly like your lead. Two is the greater art of writing, because journalism is journalism, but a lot of people really want their words to shine. Words mean a lot. Rhythm means a lot. Boom, 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 the beat of it. Because you want to keep the reader. You don't want to lose the reader. So there's an awful lot of talk about writing and how to tell that story, how to get into it.
Here's some more of that conversation. Bombs would appear to be the strongest image, but bearded men is more poetic. It lingers longer. And then Jay responds, carries you nicely into the next graph. And then Brian says, are we doing narrative or straight up? Straight up. I don't like narrative. I mean, it just goes on and on. We're standing in this war zone.
Yeah, shifting to reality now. Sometimes when we're in those war zones, we see these images before us, and we wonder, how can we tell it? If we're not expressing it to one another, it's going through our mind all the time.
Your character, Jay, again, we mentioned his girlfriend, then wife, was a photographer, and he used to stand and study her photographs to see if he could describe them, sort of training himself to describe images. Did you do that?
Yes.
Did you do that?
Yeah, I do that. I, early in my career, when I was naive, I didn't want a photographer traveling with me because I thought it ruined the intimacy I might have with the subject. And sometimes it does. But as I've gotten wiser, I hope, a photographer will say, while I'm interviewing somebody here, hey, did you see that? Or look at this viewfinder. Look at that image. And then if you open yourself up to that, that snapshot can point out something you didn't see and take you in a whole new direction. So
you describe scene after scene where Jay and Brian are, you know, fueling their computers off the Jeep that they're driving to keep their technology going, and they get to the point where they're actually writing, talking about getting to the nut, the paragraph that tells the story, the nut of the story, what's really going on, and then it breaks open the whole story. What does that feel like as a war correspondent when I'm rolling here, I've got this great story and I know how to tell it?
It feels wonderful. In certain scenes of the book, what I tried to convey is the real sense of it, because think of it, you're awakened at 5 o'clock in the morning by a bomb. Your deadline from the past day is done. You report, you travel, you report, you go through mountains, you go across checkpoints, through firefights, you get to another city that's being bombed, the electricity's out, how am I going to get my computer on? And then it's midnight, and you haven't written yet. Sometimes you just feel like, okay, I just want to fall face first in the bed and go to sleep. And then that moment when you start clicking, you awaken and you don't care, and then you might write till 6 a.m.
Well, and then how much is that flattened right out by the awareness that, you know, you as a correspondent in Kosovo, for instance, might have seen, you know, the rebels gathering in the mountains, might have seen, you know, impending war, you know, might have met a girl who'd been gang raped and brutally cut by Serbs. You know, this is incredibly compelling stuff, and it may not even be read by many Americans.
The world needs to stop and take a breath and just one moment say, why did that child die in Darfur today? Why was that boy going into Baghdad marketplace, you know, to buy milk for his mother? Why was he killed by a bomb? And if we don't explore and answer those questions, and as we as foreign correspondents don't push it in people's faces all the time, what is going to happen? And what's the point of what we do? And so we have to stay relevant, even as our papers are shrinking and foreign staffs are being cut. We can't ignore the world.
That's Jeffrey Fleischman, Cairo bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. We spoke to him earlier this year about his first fiction, Promised Virgins, a novel of jihad. By the way, he tells us he's just finished a second novel about a man losing all his memories until he has just one left, involving a mysterious man from Marrakesh. The book is called Man from Marrakesh. Look forward to it. Tomorrow on Here and Now, healthcare, climate change, war. Time Magazine's Joe Klein takes a look at President Obama's first year in office. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, how being the daughter of a poor transcendentalist shaped one of the great writers of her day, Louisa May Alcott. That's all after the latest news, Here and Now. One human rights activist says Russia today is a more frightening place than it was during the days of the Soviet Union. But there are human rights groups speaking out against cases of alleged kidnapping, torture, and murder by Russian forces. One of them, a group called Memorial, received the prestigious Sakharov Prize for Freedom of Thought from the European Parliament this fall. The BBC's Daniel Fisher reports from Moscow on Memorial's work.
Oleg Orlov, the current chair of Memorial, said the prize is an inspiration to carry on despite the constant setbacks.
It's very important for us. It's a recognition of how important our work is. It assures us that we're moving in the right direction in these difficult times. Sometimes we feel like giving up. We work hard, but we fail to achieve any significant results, especially now when we're under all sorts of pressure from the government.
This, the sound of Russian riot police storming into the St. Petersburg offices of Memorial last year, an office which had, over the years, carefully gathered evidence of Stalin's purges and first-hand accounts of the Gulag. It was all removed. Police harassment is one thing, but since the death of Anna Politkovskaya in 2006, there have been a string of high-profile murders and beatings. Natalia Estimirova, speaking here, is the latest victim. She worked for Memorial in Chechnya, and in July, she was abducted from her home, shot several times in the head, and her body dumped in a forest in the next-door Republic of Ingushetia. The public outpouring of grief for Natalia Estimirova was clear at her funeral in Chechnya. Her family's sadness shared by those she protected. For Memorial, her death meant the end of their presence in the region. It was too dangerous to send anyone to replace her.
I've come now to the offices of the Russian human rights group For Human Rights, and all around me on the walls are pictures and posters of lawyers, journalists and human rights workers who have died because of their work in exposing human rights abuses in Russia. And I've come to speak to Lev Ponomarev, an original founder of Memorial himself, and a man who knows personally what it means to stand against the Russian authorities.
If you compare it with the Soviet Union, I think Russia today is a far more frightening place for human rights activists. Then you could go to prison for a long time, but they didn't kill people. Now they kill human rights activists. You might get a bullet in the head, or you could just be bitten like I was. I was beaten up by three men who silently kicked me in the head until I lost consciousness. It turned out I had been watched and then ambushed. It was no accident.
Lev Ponomarev's experience is not unusual. Human rights groups are often accused in Russia of being foreign stooges, funded by Western powers simply to denigrate Russia. Oleg Orlov of Memorial again.
The government thinks that those who get money from abroad are suspicious and those that don't aren't. Who gets money from abroad? Human rights organizations who criticize the government's human rights record. These groups cannot get money from inside Russia.
So, a €50,000 prize from the European Parliament will only feed official suspicion that Memorial fits into that suspect category. Perhaps more worrying for the government are the voices of criticism coming from the inside.
Tortures, some manipulations with proofs and facts. It does exist.
Vladimir Lukin was appointed by the Russian president to be the country's human rights ombudsman, and he admits that Russia's human rights record is still very much a work in progress.
Our new Russian state is far from being ideal and far from being fair and just. There are many problems. There are many violations of human rights. But it is not totalitarian.
When the job of human rights ombudsman was set up, Vladimir Putin, then president of Russia, told Vladimir Lukin that he wanted someone who would talk in his other ear and tell him the stories that no one else could. Lukin himself believes that both Putin and now Medvedev do listen to him. But so far, there is no real sign that they're doing anything to stop the attacks and murders.
The BBC's Daniel Fisher, reporting from Moscow. And when we come back, the latest on Iran. That's in 30 seconds, here and now. Iranian officials are reportedly continuing their crackdown on political dissent today. According to opposition websites, several prominent anti-regime activists have been arrested. Internet access is restricted and cell phone and text messaging is sporadic. The unconfirmed death toll after Iranian police opened fire on crowds of protesters in central Tehran yesterday is as many as 10, including Ali Mousavi, the nephew of opposition leader Mir Hussein Mousavi. Today it's being reported that Ali Mousavi was assassinated and that his body has been mysteriously taken from the hospital in Tehran. Joining us is Afshin Molavi, senior research fellow at the New America Foundation in Washington, D.C., author of The Soul of Iran. Afshin, first of all, your thoughts on the news about Ali Mousavi. Again, this is from relatives and websites that support the opposition. But what do you think it means if Ali Mousavi's body has disappeared?
I think this is it's probably an attempt by the government to forestall what they fear would be continued protests to commemorate the death of Ali Mousavi. You see, in the Shia religious tradition, on the third day after a death and on the seventh day after a death and on the 40th day after a death, there are gatherings to remember the fallen. Well, Ali Mousavi is not just someone who's passed away. He is now a political martyr. And political martyrs, gatherings of political martyrs are something that the authorities want to stop. And therefore, this would explain probably why the body has been taken away.
We remember what happened after the woman was shot during protest, Netta, and her image went around the world, and she also became a martyr.
That's right. That's right. And there were commemorations on the third day, the seventh day, and the 40th day. But the Iranian authorities really mean business. I mean, they are perpetrating a massive crackdown. In addition to the confiscation of the body of Ali Mousavi, the mother and the brother of a young man who was killed in the summer protests have also been arrested, and it's mostly because they have refused to remain silent about his arrest and have refused to sign documents that he died of natural causes.
Well, let's remind ourselves, you mentioned the summer. The Iranian election was on June 12th. President Ahmadinejad's win over opposition candidate Mousavi was questioned and violently protested, continuing through the fall. Why this uptick this past weekend? Some were tying it to the death last week of Grand Ayatollah Hussein Ali Montazeri. Why? Why would that spark more protests?
Well, I think those are all good points you raised, and the death of Grand Ayatollah Montazeri was very significant because he was, in many ways, a lion of the 1979 revolution who has grown increasingly critical of the practices of the Islamic Republic, especially in the summer after the elections that were widely perceived as fraudulent and the massive violence that was perpetrated on the Iranian people. So after his death, we did see gatherings of Iranians who kind of were using his death as a launching pad for their protest. What is happening, you see, is anytime there are public gatherings, whether it be for the to commemorate a fallen cleric or to commemorate the revolution, or in the case of yesterday, to remember a religious holiday known as Ashura. These public gatherings are expropriated by the opposition, and they are used as launching pads for protests against the government. What started out last summer as a protest against the vote, when people were going out into the streets saying, "Where is my vote?" has morphed now into a much more radical protest against the very system of the Islamic Republic itself.
But how would you characterize the opposition now, Afshin? We have started by saying that the nephew of the opposition candidate, I mean, his nephew, was not, his body has disappeared, but there are reports that he was targeted, that he was run over by an SUV, and then men got out and shot and assassinated him. And yet I don't believe we've heard from his uncle, Mousavi. So
right.
where's the leadership?
You know, and that's the fundamental question. In many ways, this is a leaderless opposition. In many ways, the people who are out onto the streets today have gone beyond Mir Hussein Mousavi, who was the leading presidential candidate opponent of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who in many ways became a reluctant opposition
yes.
figure. He was never an opposition figure against the system itself. But I think figures like Mousavi, figures like the former president Mohamed Khatami, are realizing that this movement has gone beyond them. They've even been quoted as saying that this movement has gone beyond them. The danger is when you don't have opposition leaders, what you have is these kind of scattered protests that lead to violence, and you know, it's not as organized as one would like to see it.
Or as it was in 1979 with the overthrow
right.
of the Shah. But do you see any cracks in the government crackdowns? I mean, do you see, where are we on this? Do you see anything that tells you that the opposition, though sporadic and leaderless, may be having an effect?
I do. I do. And one of the things to look out for are there's been some extraordinary video posted on YouTube and other places of Iranian police officers putting their hands in the air, wearing green headbands, refusing to fire on crowds. There have been a couple of defections of members of the Basij, this security forces, the militia, who were involved in the most gruesome violence against the Iranian people. One member of the Basij gave an interview to a British television channel in which he said that, "I am at a loss. I no longer know this Islam." He was describing rapes of women that his fellow members of the Basijis undertook.
And he defected. He defected to the UK.
And he defected yeah. to the UK. That's right. There was a doctor who was a young man, 27 years old. He was a resident in one of the prisons, and he refused to sign documents saying that the prisoners were not abused and tortured. Ultimately, he died under mysterious circumstances, but he has become yet another political martyr. Whatever shred of legitimacy the government had before these events, they are losing them more and more. And ultimately, I think the ultimate irony is that the violence that was perpetrated yesterday took place on Ashura, the most important Shia religious holiday. It commemorates the uprising of Imam Hussein against an unjust caliph. It was very vital to the revolt against the Shah. And now you have an Islamic Republic killing people on the most important Islamic religious holiday of Iran.
Afshin Mousavi, a senior research fellow at the New America Foundation in Washington, D.C., also author of The Soul of Iran. Afshin, some may say it's wishful thinking on your part that you see these cracks in the government, but you do, and we'd love to have you back to talk about, you know, what Americans might do in all of this. Afshin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And before we go today, The Hard Life of the Real Little Women, that's in about a minute, here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back.
Little Women, come on in.
More than 120 years after her death, visitors still flock to Orchard House in Concord, Massachusetts, the final home of Louisa May Alcott, author of the much-loved children's book Little Women. Executive Director Jan Turnquist leads tours as the author herself.
Do you know my story, Little Women? You do? Do you know I wrote it right here, between these two windows? My father built me this desk despite those doctors who would say, you know, writing is brain work. And brain work destroys a woman's health.
Louisa's father, Bronson Alcott, was ahead of his time, someone who would be as well known as fellow transcendentalists Thoreau and Emerson, if only he could make a living. Instead, he built a desk, and Louisa used it to lift her family out of poverty. With the Little Women series, but also short stories like Transcendental Wild Oats and lurid pulp fiction written under an assumed name, Louisa May Alcott outsold Herman Melville and Nathaniel Hawthorne. Harriet Risen is author of the book Louisa May Alcott, The Woman Behind Little Women, and she's also co-author of the film with director Nancy Porter, which airs tonight on PBS stations across the country. And Harriet joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you. Hello.
And congratulations. What a wonderful read. I know you spent years on it. And it's not just a book for people who love Little Women.
That's right. Little Women is only a part of Louisa May Alcott. She was no little woman, and her life was no children's book.
No. The book tells us about an incredible time in history. It happens to be based right here in New England, the Transcendental Movement, but also about an extraordinary woman. She is extraordinary.
She was something. She was a real force. She was passionate. She was free and daring and selfless, really. She said she would do anything to support her family, and she did. Yeah. She worked at every job that a woman could hold, even actress.
Well, but let's hear a little bit about what she had to overcome. Daughter of two very distinct personalities, Bronson Alcott, as we said, the self-educated transcendentalist, and her mother, Abigail May Alcott, from a well-to-do Boston family. But they just... Louisa May Alcott moved, what, 30 times before she was 25. Explain the dynamic in the family.
Well, her father was an idealist, and he didn't really live in the real world. She described him as a man in a balloon with a family trying to hold the ropes down. He was an innovative educator. He invented recess. And 25 years before the end of slavery, he admitted a black girl, a child, to his class, and after that he was unemployable as a teacher.
I had no idea that the Alcott family was so at the mercy of relatives and other people to help them out so many times. The girls, all four daughters, never had nice clothing.
Oh, they take the hand-me-downs, and her mother would turn them inside out so that the fabric looked fresh.
So where do we see Louisa May Alcott's life pop up in Little Women?
Well, there's an exact parallel between the Alcott sisters and Little Women, the March sisters. Meg in Little Women is Anna Alcott, a lot prettier than Anna Alcott really was. Louisa said to her sister, well, someone had to be beautiful. Then Jo is Louisa, who was also called Louie, who got that kind of tomboy name. Then there is Beth, who was her sister Lizzie. Lizzie died young, as does Beth in Little Women. And then there is May Alcott, who was Amy.
And just remind us the story of the Little Women, the fictional Little Women.
There are four sisters with very distinct personalities who fight and love each other, and there's a real great inter-sister dynamic. I think that's one of the powers of the book. And with their mother, they're left to fend for themselves when their father goes away to the Civil War.
Her real-life father, Bronson Alcott, was constantly traveling to speak to people about transcendentalism. The March sisters in Little Women aren't as poor as Louisa May Alcott.
No, they're living in genteel poverty. The Alcott sisters were living in grueling poverty and really living on bread and water for long periods of time.
So where do we see the Alcott life percolate up through Little Women?
Well, I think in the personalities of the girls. They're very much parallel. The youngest sister, for instance, is more self-centered, wants to be an artist, and is determined to go her own way. Jo March, who is Louisa May Alcott's avatar, wants to write, wants to see the world, wants to do everything, and also wants to take care of her parents and fill the place of her sister, who dies. So she has to be not only the breadwinner and save them, but also to take care of them and be the domestic kind of daughter.
Which Louisa May Alcott did in real life. She ended up taking care of her entire family.
That's right. She took care of her nephews when her brother-in-law died, She took care of her sister. She nursed her sister, but she also went and was a nurse in the Civil War. She lived with it by her wits, really, and her sense of humor. And she said, if I hadn't learned to see the folly as well as the tragedy in life, I would have lost my wits long ago. I would have gone mad.
And she writes what, you know, you could say is thinly veiled stories about her own father, Transcendental Wild Oats.
That is such a funny satire. It's about the commune, their period. Really, Transcendentalism had a lot in common with the 60s. And one thing it had in common were these crazy principal communes where everyone could have starved to death. And Alcott's nearly did. They had a commune called Fruitlands, which was had very little fruit. There were 12 wizened apple trees, and they all wore linen clothes. They didn't wear anything of cotton because it was produced by slave labor. They wouldn't wear wool because it was produced by sheep labor. And they wouldn't have worn silk because it would have been worm robbery.
They would have been very at home in PETA. I don't mean that at all, you know.
Very much so, yeah, absolutely.
Uh-huh. So how did her family feel about, you know, this mocking account of what, you know, her father dedicated his life to this?
Yes, but, you know, she read Transcendental Wild Oats to him before she published it. She asked him, and he said something about the follies or the adventures of that group of people. So I think he mellowed, too, but I do think he was pained at what he put his family through. And I think he felt that he was incapable mentally of doing what he should have done, really, to support them.
Yeah. Is that where part of her rage came from? Or maybe not, because you describe a young girl who is naughty and sort of acting out at the age of three.
Oh, she was violent. Yes.
Violent.
She attacked everybody. And she seemed to really be on a mission to make her way into the power center of the family.
But this is at three.
This is at three, that's right.
What do you read into that?
Just some kind of force of personality. It was said to be the May family personality.
And then as she grew older, how much of it became a matter of being a woman way ahead of her time?
Oh, she was very conscious of that. But you have to remember, her family was way ahead of its time. Her mother was one of the founders of the Woman Suffrage Association in Massachusetts in the 1830s, and her father was in it too. And also in her children's books, she championed suffrage for women and equality for women. She was very much a feminist.
Do you think, Harriet, that, you know, we now live in the age of twilight? Do you think that Little Women and the other works from Louisa May Alcott have the same power?
Well, surprisingly, they seem to. I'd meet little girls all the time. Something about that very flawed Jo March, who dealt with her, her failings, really, and succeeded, made other people believe they could do it. There was one North Korean woman, apparently, who said, "You don't grow up to walk two steps behind your husband after you've met Jo March."
That's Harriet Ryzin. Her book is Louisa May Alcott, The Woman Behind Little Women. The film, directed by her good friend Nancy Porter, is scheduled to air tonight on American Masters on PBS stations across the country. Harriet, thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, thank you.